Sometimes that I forget to count days. I don't know how long we've been doing this, talking to empty rooms, just facing a camera and smiling at a camera as you give talks. Sometimes you wonder, do we need more talks? But it reminded me of one of those little stories that meant a lot to me when I was a young Buddhist, about it doesn't really matter just how much is out there, it's that I need to give and to share, and you need to listen and be kind. It was a story which I read in a book such a long time ago. It was a story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama when he was still in Tibet. And just like any great person who was so respected and admired by the people in Tibet at the time, he would just go travelling from place to place, not just to the cities, to the villages as well. Why? Just to let people see him. And in this one village, I should have mentioned, this story was told by a reporter, an American journalist who somehow managed to get into Tibet at the time and to follow the Dalai Lama around. And in one village, he saw that there were so many people, they were lining up, standing for quite a long time to have the opportunity to offer something to His Holiness. And then one old lady came up. The old lady was more poor than many of her other villagers. Stood out just to how, so she had so little in her life. But then she had something to offer to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And she got out a skirt, a simple cross skirt, as something which she could offer to this monk. And the monk accepted it, accepted a skirt from a very poor woman. And the journalist couldn't hold his anger any longer and exploded with rage at the Dalai Lama. You call yourself a holy man. This lady is so poor, and you accept a skirt from her. You can't wear a skirt. It's of useless to you. Why did you accept it? And at that point, the Dalai Lama said something which I'd always remember and kept with me for, almost 50 years now, probably. Because he said that it's true. I don't need a skirt. I'm a monk. I'm a male. But that woman needed to give it to me. Like that, the journalist just understood what that exchange was all about. Sometimes as Westerners or modern people in the Eastern lands, sometimes we forget what the purpose of goods or money or wealth or whatever. Sometimes it's not the case that we need it. But we do need to give and to share. It's one of the reasons why, even now, I was asked, and I don't mind acknowledging this request, from the poor Anagarikas at Bodhinyana Monastery. These are the people who make the food for us and clean up afterwards. They've been telling me that there's too much food now at that Bodhinyana Monastery. And once again, we're sort of sending it off to refugees and other places. These are things which we are in excess of. So should we stop receiving it? And the answer, of course, is no. Because people need to give. They need to share. They need to know that their monks I can't talk for the nuns because they've sort of disappeared for a while, it seems. But for the monks that need to know that we're fine, that we're cared for. And in return, it doesn't matter how many talks there are online, I know to say that I care for you. And I can give talks to the best of my ability to encourage, inspire and lead. It has a different way of working in this world. Instead of what's necessary to have, it's what's necessary to give. And at this particular time, when people are worried about economies, we should not be worried about economies. We should be worried about how much we can serve and give and help one another in so many different ways. You may be locked up in a house, but there's so many other ways which inspire people. Things which aren't really necessary, like clapping for the health workers. They probably can't hear you when you clap your hands. Or just spreading loving kindness to the people who are suffering in hospitals. Or just granting the people you live with a little bit of freedom to irritate you and to realize the irritation you're feeling, a lot of it is not because of those people you live with. It's because of the situation which they're living in right now. The worry and concern about paying the bills, about going back to work or getting a job. I often say if somebody shouts at you, it's not they're angry at you. It's actually anger doing the shouting. And they, if that anger wasn't there, would speak kindly to you. It's the anger which makes the harsh words. So understanding the reason for this, the part of giving is non-judging. Giving people a break. Giving people just excuses, even if they don't deserve them. And which means that we stop blaming one another. It's so easy to actually to try and solve the pain, the suffering in our lives by blaming somebody else. It's the government's fault. It's a particular community's fault. It's all the things which you don't like's fault. But the point of the matter is, it's no one's fault. This is part of life. It's happened before, it will happen again. And so we learn from these experiences not to blame other people and not to blame oneself, but to learn from the experiences of life. And a good example of that, I was telling this to somebody in another talk, another place recently, was that the story of that old monk. I told it many times and it's in one of my books, but nevertheless it's a fascinating little tale where he was living in the forest in the jungle. One of the great things of being a forest monk is we do try to live close to nature. We don't live in safe places often. In Bodhinyana Monastery where I live, the danger is from fires, not from wild animals. No one can say those kangaroos are, well, they are wild, but they are friends. We get to know them and we live with them, and they're very peaceful, very wonderful animals to live with. Even just the snakes. Oh, that one time when I saw this huge dugite, it's 2.7 meters long. I did not measure the dugite with a tape measure, but because it was shading on a hot afternoon by the wall of the hut where I was staying and which I built, I knew the dimensions of that hut. I remembered them. And it just managed to fit its whole long body by one of the walls, which was actually close to more like 3 meters long on the outside, 2.4 meters plus 540, about 2.9 meters long. So that was the dukkha item. And at first of all, just it didn't know what to do when it saw me. So it just looked at me and stared at me, and I just turned away. Didn't run away, but just carried on what I was doing, which was washing my arms bowl after lunch. And then when I looked again, it had turned around. It had moved so where its head, what its head was, now there was its tail. And its head was a long distance from me. You know, it could have, when I turned around, it could have come closer and struck me. And that was a very dangerous animal. Or it decided that I was no threat to it and just put its head in the opposite direction. But anyway, that's just, you like the animals in the forests. You're kind to them. And so they live with you without harming you. But anyway, in this particular case, there was another forest in the north of Thailand where I spent a long time. And this monk told me, he was in this very simple hut during a storm. And during the storm, many trees came down, bang, crash, around him. And he was up all night because it was too noisy. And he did have some fear as well. Fear that if one of those big timber trees or branches fell over his hut, it would go right through the thatched roof and bamboo rafters, right through and either injure him or kill him. To be killed would be better, because the injury had no place to go, no one to rescue him. He would be injured there for hours, days, and probably he would die, slowly. But anyway, in the morning when the storm was over, he went outside and he saw the leaves on the floor. And this was a wonderful thing, because those leaves on the forest floor lay dead, had been ripped up by the storms. And most of those leaves were the old leaves. There were still some young leaves there as well. Some fresh green leaves, which also lay dead. He looked up at the branches, and on the branches were mostly the green leaves. There were still some brown leaves up there. Even though brown leaves have been torn off, and green leaves have been torn off, and young green leaves have been torn off, and lay dead on the floor. Same leaves were up there on the branches and twigs. He learned that this is nature. Nature doesn't only take the old stuff. It also takes the middle-aged, the young and the very young. He learned from nature. So instead of blaming someone, why do young people die and old people survive things like COVID? Why is it? It's just nature. We don't blame anybody. Instead, we learn. We learn what nature can give us. We understand the limits of nature. We never ask from nature something it can't give us. Living in nature, we learn very quickly. And when we learn very quickly, when we do make a mistake, we learn to give ourselves forgiveness. Not to blame anyone. Not to blame the world or blame some God or Jesus or Buddha or not even to blame karma. But learn how to accept. Learn the rules of life. And learn how to live within those rules of life. And then we finally have so much peace and happiness and joy. And also, a lot of good fortune as well. Good fortune is not fortune. It's just we don't harm ourselves and others with fighting battles which we can never win. So little by little we learn from nature. And I did promise somebody today, earlier this week, that part of that is people sometimes have a concept called collective karma. And by that, when most people talk about karma in a Buddhist sense, they're always talking about some understanding of the bad things which happen to you in life, or it's bad karma. But so few people talk about good karma and the wonderful causes which create happiness and health and well-being for you and your family and your friends. There is a collective good karma as well. We can see this in nature, in the sense that if I do something wonderful and beautiful and kind, then I go out afterwards smiling, happy, and I share that with others. Any good act of kindness, compassion, generosity, forgiveness, which you do, it affects so many other people. It's a collective karma. You are sharing things. It's helping the whole community, not just you. And sometimes realizing the effect of your actions of body, speech, or even actions of mind as well, is very, very important. Even the actions of mind, sometimes we think that, you know, we can maybe help ourselves, but our actions don't affect others. But of course they do. Many years ago, when I would teach meditation retreats here in Perth and other places as well, towards the end of the meditation retreat, usually on the very last day, the ninth day, that I would ask people to do a guided loving kindness meditation. And by that time, their minds were reasonably well trained. They weren't restless. At least the restlessness had been subdued. So the mind had more power to really get into a real loving kindness meditation, compassion for all beings. And on part of that little guided loving kindness meditation, I did invite them to think, visualize just one important person in their life who wasn't with them, and actually to really, I used to call it zapping them with loving kindness. Just really taking your mind and wishing that person just all health, well-being, good fortune, kindness, whatever. And they would do that. But I would open my eyes just afterwards. Just afterwards. And look at the clock. Take down the time. And afterwards I would tell them the time they spread loving kindness to this one person. I would invite them afterwards. I'd invite them to, when you go home, this is the last day of the retreat, when you go home this evening, give a call to that person. And just have a normal conversation. But then, in the middle of the conversation, just ask them, oh, at that particular time, what were you doing? The reason I stopped doing that, one of the reasons I stopped doing that, was that in the evening, I would get so many phone calls back from the people who said, it worked. I know the person was in another country, and I called them at that particular time. What were you doing? He said, oh, it's amazing, I was thinking of you. Just how kind you were to me, or something. And I was just proving to myself as much as others how the mind does connect with each other. And that way there is a collective way of doing some good karma. It's one of the reasons why in traditional Buddhism, if you do go to the temple and you just, you know, do a little offering to the monks or to the nuns, then afterwards we do share the merits. We give what we've made to our parents, grandparents, to people who are no longer here, who were really important to us. We share it to all those beings. Why? Because it works. We make our individual karma, good karma, much, much bigger. Collective to all the people we can remember. It's another way of looking at this. But why is it that people always think of these things as only pertaining to bad karma, looking for people to blame? Why have we got COVID? Is it because we've done something wrong? All of us have done something wrong. Oh, you can't really say that. We're human beings subject to birth, old age, suffering and death. That's normal, that's usual. Many times here, I've told people, whenever you go see the doctor, never say, there's something wrong with me, doctor, I'm sick. But to turn that around and say, there's something right with me, doctor, I'm sick again. That this time is just usual, it's normal, there's nothing wrong with this. Nothing wrong with it, it's right. So instead of blaming, or sometimes if you blame the people you live with for not reacting properly, they're all learning, they're all growing. If you blame others, the blame, sure enough, will come back to you. In other words, by that I mean you blame yourself. You know that human beings are somewhere in our education system, we haven't really learned just how to make mistakes and still feel at ease with ourselves. So not looking at mistakes as some personal failing which will mean that we're, you know, somehow that when our brain was given to us, it just, you know, at the end of the line, or we got a faulty model. All brains are the same. All human beings, there's not one human being I've seen who never makes mistakes. Even good old Ajahn Chah, one of the wisest people, kindest people I've ever known, he made mistakes. But when we make mistakes, we learn from them rather than blaming. The old AFL code, acknowledge, forgive, and learn. So we acknowledge the mistakes. Not acknowledging mistakes, acknowledging the nature in which we live, acknowledging our nature, that we're imperfect human beings. And really getting to understand that and accept that. When we understand our faults and failings, then we learn from them. And when we learn from them, we grow out of them. We make different mistakes, but nevertheless, we don't blame ourselves for making mistakes. We don't blame anybody. Because this is not a world of being perfect. It's a world of learning. It's a world of growing. It's a world of learning how to be better human beings, not worse human beings. And any sort of pandemic like COVID, anything which changes the way we live, is always a great opportunity for growing. You're learning things that you've never learned before. It's amazing, just people are just living together for a change. Instead of just passing each other in the morning as you get ready for work, you're in the same house for long periods of time. And you can't go out. You're stuck together. And you learn. You learn about yourself and you learn about the people you live with. And as you learn those great lessons, you do make mistakes, but you acknowledge those mistakes. You don't hide them. If you try and deny the mistakes which you make in life, you're never learning from them. So I saw this such a long time ago, which is no why that time that poor little Annie Garrica, Australian fellow, and who came to monastery, this was, a long time ago now, and I was just the new abbot, so that must be about 25 years ago now. And anyway, there he said that he broke one of his precepts. He'd done a terrible thing. He'd gone into the kitchen late at night and made himself a sandwich. And worst of all, he ate it. And that poor little Anagarika. Now, Anagarika means just a postulant, someone who's training to become a novice monk and then a full monk. That poor little novice, not novice yet, the poor little Anagarika, his face went more white than his clothes when I told him what the punishment would be, because he demanded a punishment. I tried to forgive him, but he wouldn't accept forgiveness. He's one of these people who thought like forgiveness was weak. He'd never grow with forgiveness, he thought. So he wanted a punishment, and so that was the time, I'm sure that you've heard this story before, many of you. I've just been reading the early history of Australia. And so I said, well, if you want a punishment, I'll give you a traditional Australian punishment. 50 strokes at the cat. And that's when his face went white. And his... I shouldn't really laugh at this, but I still can recall it very clearly. His face went white and he was shocked. You know, he actually thought that Ajahn Brahm would whip him. Of course, we never do anything like that as Buddhist monks, which are so gentle and kind. But he thought he was going to get a whipping for his mistake. And of course, that's when I told him what 50 strokes of the cat meant. And at that time, we did have two cats at our monastery. A little Kit Kat and Mitt Kat. Two cats. They would fight, those two cats, but at night time when it was cold, they would cuddle up together. It was wonderful to see. They were friends. Anyway, they said, find one of those cats and stroke it 50 times. That's called the 50 strokes of the cat punishment. Learn some compassion, some kindness. Learn something. Grow from your mistakes. Don't punish them. And then when you learn from mistakes, you don't blame and seek for punishment. This wonderful sense of freedom. You realize it is okay to make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. And when you see your own mistakes and you see other people's mistakes, you don't blame them. You can have so much more peace in life. And so much growth. No people actually like you because they feel a sense of safety around you. Other people in this world are always looking to find fault with this one and find fault with that one. But you're not trying to find fault with anybody. You're understanding, yes, mistakes happen. And we just learn from them. And we grow from them. We don't blame anybody. We don't blame ourselves. We grow from the mistakes of life. And little by little, that means that we find we don't have to be perfect. In our world, we try and get a perfect world and we try and be perfect. And that goes totally against the nature which you see. The nature which you see in life, I never met a perfect person. I already mentioned that Ajahn Chah made mistakes. There's no such thing as a perfect person who doesn't make mistakes. We all learn and grow. We're humans. And when we learn and grow, we get wiser and more compassionate. What is compassion and kindness anyway? The kindness there is just understanding and looking at someone who makes a mistake and smiling. And just given this beautiful sense of reassurance. Yes, you made a mistake. I made those mistakes before. You're human. Welcome. You belong. I say this simile way too often, but it fits in right now. The old simile of the forest. There's not one perfect tree in the forest in which I live in Serpentine. Every tree is bent and scarred and twisted and but they're all beautiful. Even if it's not perfect tree, it belongs. It's welcomed. Every human being, doesn't matter if they are sick, if they are ill, if they stink, or if they say rotten things, they're welcome in this world. Just like every tree in a forest. And they interact. Every tree helps each other. Is one of the reasons why has a healthy forest. Each in its own way. So the same with each one of you. Remember that story of that great Catholic Saint Mother Teresa, where that when there was another journalist with her and she was picking up this poor fellow from the gutters of Calcutta, who had very bad cancer and was stinking and oozing and the sort of person which a lot of people would just be repelled, almost naturally, in spite of their kindness, be pushed away. But this Mother Teresa just went straight for her and just, him, and just helped him up and picked him up and took him to her little hospital sanctuary to look after him. And they asked him, well, didn't you see his smell and disgusting stuff coming out from his body and all the sores of the illness? She replied, no, I never saw that. I just saw a person who needed love and kindness. It's a wonderful thing when we look at a human being. We don't see their faults. We don't see their anger. We don't see something else in them. We see that kindness in them. We see that humanity in them. And actually that's what we look at. That's called forgiveness. Not blaming. It's not seeing the two bad bricks in the wall, the 998 good bricks. It's not watering the weeds, it's watering the flowers. It's just an acceptance of the nature of life. Never blaming the storm for taking so many young green leaves and leaving them dead on the ground. Understanding this nature is not to be blamed or controlled, but this nature is to be understood and lived with, rather than lived against. Even my own body, I live with it rather than trying to control it. So often if it's tired, I take it to bed and give it a good rest. So often if it's a little aching, I move it or rub it. I'm kind to it rather than trying to control it. The same with all those monks which I train in Bodhinyana Monastery. Always being kind to them. Never trying to control them or tell them off. And when they do stupid things, I laugh with them. Even today, one of the monks, he was just helping me when people were dropping off food. And they were telling us what they were dropping off. And somebody today dropped off some sourdough. And this monk put up his hands and said, sourdough, 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 like my three sadhus. It's a stupid joke. But then I laugh my head off with him. So we can enjoy each other's company and humour, never be so critical of one another. And that means that we live in a harmony. You learn how to live in harmony with people of so many different backgrounds and trainings. In Bodhinyana Monastery, in Serpentine where I live, you learn to live in harmony with your own body, never blaming it, but working with it. You learn how to live in harmony with all other human beings, never blaming them for what they are, what they've done. That's another problem. But just giving them some reassurance that no matter who they are and what they've done, they are welcome. They're welcome as a friend. I do that because I need to do it. That's my giving. They do that because they need to receive it. This is one of the reasons why that in my life as a monk, it's important for me to serve, for me to give, for me to look after other people. And sometimes when I'm by myself, for me to serve and look after my own body. And be kind to it. Never to train it by being angry at it or being blaming it or finding fault with it. But always, we don't have any cats anymore. But one of the monks wanted to get some more cats in Bodhinyana Monastery. They're terrible because they would destroy so much other wildlife, like little possums which are now coming out again. But the reason why he said, well, we need to get a cat, was because there were so many rats and mice at this time in Bodhinyana Monastery. But we have the Buddhist mouse traps, which can catch those mice and rats. They're very efficient. And so this week, the Anagarika's caught 8 rats, and a big one yesterday. And so before they took it away to the forest, they don't kill it. We just let it be happy and well somewhere else in the forest. But anyway, that I always gave some chanting, a blessing to this little rat. And so what are you doing that for? The rat has been causing the kitchen people so much problems. So it doesn't matter, it's a human, it's a living being. So this male rat, I just started chanting some verses for loving kindness. But not just chanting it, but meaning it. And of course this little rat was running around the cage trying to find a way out. And just for the few moments when I was chatting, it stopped to look me right in the eyes. And it was actually peaceful for a few seconds as I gave it a beautiful loving kindness chant of good health and happiness. Same sort of chant which I give to each one of you. It was something which I could do, some way I could serve, a little bit which I can give for the happiness of a little rat in a cage who was very scared and didn't know where he was going or what he would do, to give some help. So little by little that we do look after one another and help one another, whatever happens in our life, any difficulties, there's always something we can do. We don't blame or get negative. We look on the positive side of whatever we have to experience. We're learning, we're growing, becoming better human beings. And that is our path. So, that's one of the reasons why I keep on giving talks here. It's one of the reasons why people keep listening, even though sometimes people say, oh, we've heard all your stories before. But I often mention that I've heard them more than anybody, because I tell them. But they're meaningful. And to me, when I tell those stories, I can remember the incident and the kindness, the emotions, the joy and the effect which it had. It is how powerful that is to serve and help other human beings. For me, I cannot give you any money or any food. What I can give is just my experience and kindness. And any stories which can help and serve. And of course, when those stories really do work, people send me these beautiful emails or letters saying, thank you so much. If it wasn't for that they would have actually probably been suicidal or even committed suicide. But learning how to see things in a different way. Oh, what was that occasion years ago? It just comes up into my mind. I did get an invitation, this was quite a few years ago now, to go to Thailand. And it was, I go to Thailand quite often. But this was a special invitation from the Australian Embassy in Thailand. And the reason why these people wanted to invite me, because there was four couples. Two couples were divorced. Two couples were separated. And somehow or other they got a copy of that first book which I wrote, The Opening the Door of Your Heart. They got a copy of that book, and it worked. They came together again, even the couples which were divorced. And they said, we just wanted to see you, to say thank you. So they got together and sent me a ticket to go to Thailand. So I did an event for them, just to say, let them say thank you. It's a beautiful thing. I serve. And I get this wonderful service back. That makes a beautiful world. Of course, I'd never been married or had relationships before I was a monk. But nevertheless, you know the pain, the difficulty, the hopes which get shattered when a marriage breaks down or when a divorce happens. And actually to get those four people just seeing life in a different way, seeing each other in a different way, and be able to come together and have some more peace and happiness. I mean, their children were just so overjoyed. And they, of course, had more peace in their life. simply because a monk gave. So we do need to give, and that's beautiful. I say this personally because my personal stories are the ones I really know and ones I can vouch for. But this really makes a more beautiful world. In the time of COVID, to give people that hope, to give people like a different way of looking at life, and to stop wasting time blaming somebody or blaming this or blaming that, that helps no one at all. And of course, in life you get blamed. And we blame ourselves because we feel that's the appropriate way to deal with mistakes. Blame. Instead, the other way to learn about mistakes. So the other way to deal with mistakes is to learn and grow. Blame just creates anger, annoyance. We never get anywhere. Instead, we learn and grow. So, that's the talk for this evening. And now we usually have the questions, if there are any questions for this evening. And those questions will be answered as best I possibly can. Very good. Thank you. Here we go, we've got three questions today. Okay, from India, from Poland, and from the USA. First of all, from India. How do I deal with anxiety when my mother is seriously ill? Please remember that I'm not quite sure who I'm speaking to here from India, but sometimes I remember that it's not really your mother. You don't control her. Especially from India, you've come into this life and your mother cared for you and you love her and make sure she's happy and well. But nevertheless, we always understand that one day, your mother will die or you will die first. One day the separation happens. That's actually normal. That's usual. That's part of our life. And that's part of our leaving one another. And when your mother is seriously ill, it's a good reminder to you. And it should never be depressing, because I always give that simile of the concert. When I used to go to concerts as a young man, I always knew that the concert would end. When it did end, you know, I was one of the first ones, it was a good concert, to stand up and clap and shout for more. The encore. You'd always get an encore or two. But then, it did come the time when the band had to go home. The orchestra had to put all its instruments away and walk off the stage. And I had to go too. It was over. It was finished. And I enjoyed that time so much. And when I left, knowing the concert was over, I never once felt sad. Remember, your time together with your mother is like a concert. It's a beautiful time you have. But be honest to it. The concert will end one day. So enjoy it. If it ends when your mother is, or you haven't spent too much time together, it doesn't matter about the length of the concert, the quality of the performance. That was the most important part. So instead of having anxiety, we have this wonderful sense of like peace that my mother's going to die one day. I'm going to make sure that the time I have with her, I'm not going to waste it in anxiety and worry, because your mother will see that straight away. You can't hide it. Instead, I'm going to have this beautiful sense of peace. If you have a few days or a few weeks or a few years, I don't know how long you have, then make it really count. Have a beautiful time together. Not with anxiety, but with love. And when she does eventually depart, make sure that she departs with your blessing. Not with your tears. With a thank you. You've been a wonderful mother to me. I love you so much. I can't go with you everywhere. I hereby let you go. And I always remember what you taught me. I'll never forget you. And all those wonderful lessons will always be in my heart. Not the tears, but the joys and the smiles and the laughter which we share together throughout our life together. Thank you so much for being my mum. Unfortunately, I don't know why it is that even in a great spiritual land like India, sometimes we forget these things. We have anxiety instead not learn from the West, I would say. We don't get anxious if your mother seriously ill. We relax and have a wonderful time together. The short time you have left, make it count. And from Poland, how do I deal with conflict with somebody? What if I can forgive, but the angry person cannot? How not to lose self-esteem facing this difficult situation? First, self-esteem. What is self-esteem anyway? Who's judging you? Sometimes we judge ourselves. But, you know, you become a much, I would call like a higher being if you want. Certainly a more spiritually advanced being. When you can forgive somebody, you don't lose self-esteem, you lose your sense of self and all the problems that comes with a sense of self and control of being a master or mistress of whatever's happening in your life. So, please lose your self-esteem, at least that type of self-esteem, and being someone who's much more free. And if you feel you need to forgive, and forgive them. If they get angry at you, don't ever think it's because of you. There must be something else. Okay, I can't. Again, this is one of my other favorite stories. And it's a bit more of a fun story. I don't know when the last time I told it was. Hopefully it wasn't last week. Because, you know, during the week I give many other talks. You know, some for the BSWA, some for some other people. So I don't know what I actually say when I said it, but this particular story was when a husband had the afternoon off work. And the afternoon off work, and he was at home, and his wife said, "Oh, darling, you know, I'm short of some sugar. Can you get some sugar from the marketplace for me?" And he said, "Yeah, certainly, darling, but I've never been to the marketplace before. You have to tell me what to do and how to get there." So she drew him a little mud map, gave him some cash and a basket. Oh, it wasn't the sugar, it was some eggs. Sorry, some eggs. Gave him a little map and some money and told him where the egg stall was in the market. And off he went, a happy little fellow, trying to do a service for his good wife, to get some eggs from the market. And as soon as he got into the marketplace, this young fellow came up, maybe 17 or 18, and went right in front of his face and said, "You are the ugliest person I've ever met in my whole life. Your face is like a camel. Not the front end of a camel, the back end of a camel. And you smell like the back end of a camel as well. I don't know what you've been washing yourself with, but it smells like camel poo." And of course, that's how I usually say this story. I can go into much greater detail on this, but I'm a very sensitive monk, so I don't know all the rotten words which people say to one another because I don't use them myself. So anyway, I only know the camel story. So anyway, he was just abused and said terrible things to in this marketplace, in public, and a poor old husband, "I don't even know you. Why are you saying these terrible things to me?" And this young man kept on just abusing and swearing at this poor husband. And the husband turned around and went back home. And as soon as he got back in the house, his wife said, he slammed the door. His wife said, "You're back early, darling, and why do you slam the door?" "Well, this place is a terrible place. This place is marketplaces. These people are so uncouth and so uncivilized, and they're just terrible, and I don't know where to go there ever again, and that is a terrible place. I wouldn't send anybody down. I don't know how you handled it." And he went on and on and on like that. And when he calmed down, his wife said, "What happened?" And when he told his wife what had happened, she explained to him that poor young man, when he was young, had an accident. He fell over and hit his head on the concrete floor. He got brain damage. And the poor young man just is incurable. He can't go to school. He will never get a job. He can't find another nice young girl to share his life with. He's brain damaged. He gets angry at everybody. But we know it's not him. He's just, you know, he's crazy. But as soon as the husband heard that, the husband was at peace. He wasn't being criticized by anyone who knew anything about him. So when his wife realized that the husband was at peace, she said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." And so off he went to the market for a second time. And the guy came up to him again, this young man, and saying, "You're ugly, you're stinky." That never really mattered to the husband now, because he realized the poor young man had been hit on the head and was brain damaged. So he got the eggs, and he wished this young man, who was still swearing at him and cursing him all the way in the marketplace, he wished him a happy evening. And the reason behind that story, the reason I tell it often, is if the angry person is the person you're with or you have conflict with, and they're always getting angry at you, just really don't take it personally. Just assume. Just assume. They must have hit their head. And they got some brain damage. Because that's how the Buddha described it. Anger is a mental illness. It's a craziness. So if people get angry at you, give them compassion back. Poor thing. You only have to be with them for a certain number of hours every day. They have to live with themselves 24/7. So it was a good reflection. And if you don't give anger back when you receive anger, after a while you don't lose your self-esteem. Your sort of inner strength grows immensely. You really get strong. That's what I've found in my life. Many times people get angry at me. There was the other little story, this monk. He had terrible migraines, I found out later on. And once he got very angry at me in front of all the other monks. I was only just a young monk. And he shouted at me, "Brahma Wangsa, you're drying your bowl with a rag you use to wipe your spittoons. That's a filthy habit." It was really over the top what he said to me. But I was wise enough even then, as a young monk, to know exactly what to do. I looked at him silently as he was glaring down at me. And then I went over to the rag bag to change the cloth. I never said anything. But as soon as I returned and wiped my bowl with a clean rag rather than the same rag which I used to wipe the spittoon, and I looked at him, he went red in the face and walked away. Other monks were doing that. We always did that. But instead of arguing with this angry monk, I refused to get angry back. It was very clear just who won that confrontation. He never got angry at me again. He got angry at other monks, but never at me. It's just a waste of time getting angry at you. So I don't fire up. So anyway, that's sometimes when you have conflict with somebody, make sure that they may have conflict with you, but make sure you don't have conflict with them. Conflict doesn't have to be back and forth. It can be a one way. And if they have conflict with you, but you don't have conflict with them, after a while their conflict just disappears. Because it doesn't get fed. Okay, the last question here, or maybe some more later on. What do I do when destruction happens in front of me? Should I get involved? What do I do when I'm feeling helpless? There is only a limited amount of things which you can do in this world. And as a Buddhist monk, sometimes I feel so helpless. I can give a talk, but that's not that much. And there was that time when there was this gentleman, often mention him at this time because this occurred the last time which I did have a flu, just an ordinary flu, and that was almost 30 years ago here in Perth. And at the time there was a gentleman who was one of our regulars on Friday night talks, and he fell off a roof when he was trying to fix some gutters or something. And after he fell off the roof, you know, he went a bit sort of crazy. He started dressing up as, well, literally dressing up as Elvis Presley and trying to act like him. And this was many years ago, and so the care which he had was, you know, could have been better. But nevertheless, that I remember he, yeah, this was the first year I came here, because I remember the occasion when, in the garden at our previous centre in Magnolia Street, he came, he had a psychotic episode, and he had a walking stick, because he was still, you know, he couldn't walk properly. And he started waving quite violently that stick at me. But he always missed me. It was just like he got the stick and trying to whack me on the head, but he would always miss, and it was obvious for me that it was on purpose. He wouldn't hit me. I just sat there talking to him, calming him down for about half an hour. And at the end of that little confrontation, you know, he trusted me. He trusted me so much that whenever he had a psychotic episode, he'd always come to me. And if he couldn't actually come, I had so much more time in those days and could really look after him. If I couldn't help him, then he couldn't come to the temple, then he would call up and I'd talk with him over the telephone. But I'd always managed to calm him down. And at this particular time, that Bantiji, Venerable Gunaratana, was in Perth, and I was down to do a meditation retreat with him, you know, just to practice, not to teach. I was a young monk at the time here. And then he was, I got this terrible flu. And I was so disappointed, I just couldn't go on this retreat. But the flu was way too bad. And so I was actually bedridden. And that was when somebody came up to me and said, oh, this fellow, he needs to talk to you, he's having one of his episodes. And I said, I can't. Physically, I can't. I had this terrible flu. I was in bed, just tossing and turning with a fever. And then, half an hour later, he killed himself. Committed suicide. And I often tell people that story because it's a true story, no exaggeration. I don't feel bad about it because there's nothing I could do. So destruction was happening right in front of me. If I was healthy, I could have helped him, but you know, we all get sort of sicknesses from time to time. It's been a really long time since I've been really sick like that. So I tried my best, but that's as far as I could go. Should you get involved, sometimes you make decisions. You make decisions. I remember as a young monk, I sometimes made some stupid decisions, but I always had some good karma somewhere to get away with it. I was telling Ajahn Brahmali just a day or two ago that he asked me some of the silly stories, which are silly things which I did as a young monk. And this particular time that I was, because he doesn't accompany me when I come to give talks, and so there's many of the talks which he, and the stories he hasn't heard. And this was the time when I was in London visiting my mother. And this evening, one evening, I had an invitation to give a talk at the Sri Lankan temple, which was in Heathfield Gardens in Chiswick. My mother lived in Acton. It was only maybe an hour's walk. And so, and that's my area where I grew up. So I knew that area. I wouldn't get lost. So I went on one sort of one route, and it went past this housing estates, the Sink Estates, you know, which was a hotbed of crime, apparently. But I never knew that, but this is where I grew up. And when I was there, it was just an ordinary place where people lived. But anyway, that was where, as I was walking along the pavement, along the side of the road, which was paved, I saw these young people, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, maybe 15-year-olds as well. And they were just a gathering. I don't know what they were going to do next. Maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 of them, and more people were coming. And when they saw me, of course, they didn't really know. This was so many years ago, you know, what a Buddhist monk was. But at least I knew I was Buddhist, because they started chanting, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. And as I got closer, Buddha, 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 Buddha. Now the sensible thing to do was for me to cross the street and go to the other side, or turn around and run away or something. But I decided, no, that's not what I'm going to do. So I just kept on walking to them, not increasing my pace, not slowing down. As they're getting closer and closer, Buddha, 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 they were chanting, oh no, many more of them than me. And as I got even closer, then I lifted my arms. Remember, this was about 30 years ago, in a kung fu pose. At least what I thought of was a kung fu pose. The only kung fu I ever knew was from the TV show Kung Fu, with David Carradine or something. Now I saw that before I was a monk. And so I went into my so-called kung fu pose, and I just carried on walking with no fear, but just stupidity. I could have been really damaged. And they just parted, and I walked right through and just carried on walking without turning around. It was really cool, but I was only sort of making it up. So, should I get involved? If you're a stupid monk like me, you maybe can do things like that, but it'd be much better to turn around and go another way. So I was feeling helpless, so I just played up to it. When I'm feeling helpless, so often you feel helpless. So it is. There's always something you can do. Destruction happens in front of you. You can't change the destruction, but you can always learn from it. You can grow from it. You can't help everybody. Maybe one person you may be able to help and be kind to. You just, even a smile or think, anything I can do. Even small things can be of great assistance and help. So, give it a try, see what you can do, and just work from there. Okay, there's only other 3 questions. There's any other questions there from the booth? Yeah, come on, yeah. Do another. Okay, yes. We're just getting the audio visual person to get it from the phone. Because sometimes, on these occasions, I often say there's no questions from the audience, then I usually just end the talk and then all the people in the hall come up and line up to ask their personal questions. But because there's no one in the hall, just the audiovisual team, that's one of the reasons why there's not so many questions today. And I have more time to answer questions online. So we're just going to get those questions, if they somehow come, from the audiovisual booth. And then we can see if we can answer maybe a couple more questions. It's only 9:06 here in Western Australia, and a nice quiet night. So peaceful these days, when most people are in their houses. I don't know what they're doing. Hopefully they're listening. Some of them are listening to my talk. And if not, they are at least they're being peaceful and not arguing with one another or being in conflict with one another. Because sometimes when there is conflict, you know, sometimes that can even mean we don't go to sleep at night. I can't go to sleep. We may lay down, we think about the conflict. It's always a great training as a monk. Even if you do have conflict with somebody, you just when you go back to your room, you leave that conflict outside. You don't bring it into the place where you live or the place where you sleep. Even if that person lives in the same house as you, hopefully you have your own room and you can make sure you go there. And just so the conflict stays outside. This is my room and I'm just going to be at peace with myself here. And all of that trying to figure out sort of what you're going to do tomorrow, the next day when you meet that person. All that thinking about the past is a waste of time. Thinking about the future is a waste of time. And even thinking about the past, who said what and who did what, that's a waste of time too. A lot of these occasions we just need to rest. Give ourselves a break. Give ourselves a time where we can just find some peace and happiness away from the conflict. It's one of the reasons why that when we did have some of these conferences which I go to, one of the therapists had a beautiful idea of how to deal with conflict in life and people who had conflict. What they were doing was just taking people out into nature, into the forests, the cliffs, by the ocean. And there was something in those beautiful parts of the world where you were away from the people who were triggering the problems, which created a space where a person could see there was more to life than those few problems. It's the old story, I've said this many times, the hand, when my hand's right in front of my face, I can't see anybody. When I put it to where it belongs, out here, I can see my hand and everything else as well. It puts things in perspective. Okay. So just using on the iPhone. Very good. First question. My father passed away a while ago due to sickness. A month later, my cousin dreamt of him. She said he was in pain. Does this dream represent something? What can I do to help my dad? If you just have one dream like that, it doesn't mean much at all. So he had some sickness, was in pain, and sometimes that's just how we remember people. If that dream keeps on coming up time and time and time again, then it may mean something. And if that dream comes up again and again and again, and then I would just do some good karma for him. I don't care whether he was a Buddhist or a Christian, but if he was a Christian and he was in pain and he needs something, then just go give a donation to the church or something. Whatever you think would make him happy, you do that. And that's only when these dreams come up time and time and time again. This next question from Sri Lanka. Being a teacher, how do I apply loving kindness when the students go against the disciplinary rules? How you practice loving kindness when a student goes against, you know, the rules of the school? You take him aside and you just explain to them what those rules are there for and why we have rules. If only my teachers, when I was at school, would tell me just why we had these rules, what the purpose was, because some of those rules I thought were stupid rules. I never understood them. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, why keep them. And so if those students know why we have those rules, why we have the rules about, say, cars speeding down the road, what are they there for? So these days, a lot of times, people just, you know, find out just where the speed cameras are and slow down there and speed up afterwards. And it just misses the point. Now, why do we have, like, social distancing during the COVID crisis? And many times people, especially I was reading in the United States, don't want to keep those rules. So it's not just the students go against the disciplinary rules. No, people in places like the United States go against the wise advice of the doctors. So, but if it's explained to them why this is important and they understand, they get it, then the disciplinary rules become just common sense. As a Buddhist monk, you know, this is 227 main rules I keep, plus hundreds of others. Well, they're not a burden at all because I understand what they're there for. Because I understand what they're there for, they become like common sense and very easy.
from Canada. I'm a research scientist and killed many mice in my PhD project. And I don't want to do that anymore. Would not in the future. What can I do to repair that karma? Thank you. Then just, if you have got your research scientist, you have got some funds, see if you can use those funds, a donation to projects which can do the same research, but not on live animals, on sort of other sort of mechanisms which don't sort of which harm beings even less. So if you are concerned about many mice were killed or for your PhD project, hope the PhD project was worthwhile, and those mice are now gone. To repair that karma, just see if you can adopt a mouse or something and keep that mouse in your house and make sure that mouse has a wonderful life. I'm not sure, but just to learn that these are not just beings to be experimented on, but these are people, or not people, but beings which have their own character, personalities. I remember once I just managed to rescue a white mouse when I was a young monk in Thailand. And I built a cage for it, and I would feed it and look after it. And one day, that mouse, you know, it could, when I was cleaning up its cage, it would run on my shoulders, it would never want to escape. And one day I went there in the morning and I found there was a snake in the cage. Or at least it was half in the cage. The snake had sort of tried to kill the mouse and eat it, but it had managed to just put its, the snake had put its head, slid through some of the holes in the fencing around the cage, and the mouse had attacked it and killed it. And that mouse was a very tough little mouse, but around me it was just really kind. But then one day when somebody else was looking after the mouse ran away. And of course we couldn't find it afterwards. The mouse had freedom, but probably didn't last very long in the Thai jungle. So anyway, it's wonderful if you can. Just, you killed many mice before, but then don't kill any again. And see how you can help a mouse, or give some donations or encouragement so people can do the same research without harming our mice. From Sri Lanka, how many times should a person be forgiven if they're making the same mistake over and again, if they don't value or respect your compassion? I remember being asked this question in Singapore some time ago, how many times should you forgive? And the answer is always one more time. So, this is, for the person that don't value or respect your compassion, just there may be hard cases, eventually they will respect your compassion, because it's rare that a person can forgive so much. But don't just forgive and forgive and forgive. We forgive and try and learn. So, you know, what is the problem with that person? What are they doing which keeps causing the difficulty for you? And if they won't listen to you, that sometimes they have some other friends who will listen to who they will listen to. And they're the people you can actually go to. In other words, don't always go direct. Go a roundabout route. So that way you can influence them. But for you, it's great to forgive. That's it. Okay. So very good. Have you got any more there? Okay, I'll do a couple more. Is that okay? Thank you. My husband is unfaithful to me during this period. I sleep at 2:30 a.m. daily and don't sleep well, don't eat well. My husband is trying to meet the girl despite being locked down in Singapore. Can you enlighten me? Okay. I don't know, just your husband being unfaithful to you is... Okay, I'll tell this story. There was one of the people in Singapore, she was a marriage counsellor. And she I had a client who had a similar problem. He said, my husband is always coming late back from work. He says it's from work, but I'm pretty sure he's got a mistress. What should I do? And I really want to divorce him. And the marriage counselor said, listen, if you divorce him now, he'll be happy. He'll be free of you so he can stay with his mistresses. He said, no, don't try and divorce him yet. Instead, our plan is that you try and get a bit of a makeover, get some expensive dresses, be kind to him, and then little by little he fell in love with you once, maybe you can get him to fall in love with you again. And once he's fallen in love with you, then divorce him. And she thought, wow, yeah, what a great idea, because you know, she didn't like him. She'd been hurt a lot, and so she was quite happy to hurt him. That was her plan. And so every week, she would go to the marriage counsellor, and the marriage counsellor, how's it going? Yeah, you know, he's actually paying more attention to me now. Now I've got some nice hairstyle and clothes, and I'm wearing a bit of makeup, I'm kinder to him. Yeah, he's staying home a bit longer. And he comes back home earlier. They're great, great, great. But has he fallen in love with you yet? No, not yet, not yet. So don't divorce him yet, just carry on. And it took about 3 months. And after 3 months, she stopped going to see the counsellor. So the counsellor called her up and said, what's going on? She said, oh, he's coming home really early now. And he's so kind to me, so loving. Great, said the counsellor, now's the time to divorce him. Oh no, he's such a lovely husband now. And she said that was the plan all along. So anyway, just if you try to meet another girl, then can you not just see if you can be a little bit more attractive if you still want that relationship to continue? Find out what he likes. And he's unfaithful to me during this period. Again, he's trying to meet the girl despite being locked down. Yes, that's a good benefit of actually being in Singapore. And so learn how to fall in love with your husband again. See if he can fall in love with you. Kindness, care, and understanding one another. It's the most wonderful time because he can't meet that girl and he can't go very far. Maybe that's a good time. Sometimes if he is if he has children, sometimes the children can talk to him and say, we're embarrassed with you, Father. You know, that we try to live up and respect, live up to your example and respect you. That's what you're doing. This is a terrible example. Anyway, the next question. I have a question. What is your recommendation for handling someone who was abusive? They refuse to communicate and it's best for me to let go, but I feel bad about it all the time. Again, it depends upon the level of the abuse. If it is physical abuse, it's certainly the case that you should call the police, because that can create a huge amount of danger for you and your family. And it's not as if you're doing this to punish the fellow or the girl, whatever, because the person needs some help. And sometimes, according to the police, they can get some sociologist or psychologist to actually to try and find out what the problem is. And if they refuse to communicate and you live in the same house, I'm not quite sure what the situation is, then sometimes it is the best thing for you to let go. Don't feel bad about it, because I don't know why you blame yourself. You're not being the abusive one, it's probably them. And sometimes we do just walk out and have another relationship, another place, another time, or just stay by yourself. Because I don't know why that sometimes people always feel that we should keep on going and we should try and change them. And after a while, it means you're not living in the real world. You're just getting into more and more danger. Sometimes it is the right time to realize the relationship has gone past its use-by date. Like everything else in this world, sometimes, whether it's a a packet of milk, you look upon it there as best before a certain time. Sometimes relationships are the same. But if ever you do decide to leave, please don't blame anybody. Certainly don't blame yourself. You gave it everything you had, but it wasn't enough to change them. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I am very desperate for making very close friends, and as a result, people run away from me. How to let go of the desperation? You know, you'll find as many other people like you who also are trying to get good friends, but at least you're realizing what the problem is. You want to have a best friend so much. Don't have a best friend, just have an ordinary friend. And over the weeks, the months, the years, many of those friends will become your best friends. And try and go to places where people are like you, you know, they're similar to you, they're enjoying the things which you like. So therefore the friendship happens. If obviously it's not the best time to make good friends, you know, when we can't meet one another. Of course you can have friends. Of course you can have friends when, online. But those friends online are nothing like when you have the personal friends of having a cup of coffee together or just doing things which you like together. So if you can go to those communities, and if you're a Buddhist and are going to a Buddhist society, and after a while that people do talk to one another, obviously not at this time but other times, and if you talk to one another like that, then of course you soon get this wonderful friendship. And they don't have to be exactly the same as you. And just be kind to them. It's a kindness makes friends. Because kindness is a rare commodity in this world. When people see it, they just love it so much, they just want to spend more time with you. So be kind. Oh, that's the last question, I think. That's it, yes. Okay, so thank you for listening. And this was at the suggestion of a wonderful young man. Young man, I'm not quite sure how old he is, but always asked me, he's from Medan, to do some chanting at the end of the talk. So here's the shorter version of the Chulamangala Sutta. The Chulamangala blessing, sorry. Sabaroga Vinimuto Sabasantapo Vajito Sabavera Mati Gando Nibuto Chato Wangbawa Sabitio Vivachantu Sabarogo Vinasatu Mate Bhavan Vantarayo Sukhitika Yuko Bhava Apiva Dhanhasilitsa Nichang Vuta Pachalino Chataro Dhamma Vatanti Ayuvano Sukhang Balang. Good night, everybody, and stay safe.